copyright on the internet. I should explain to you that one of the reasons that we have such a compressed program that starts at 8 in the morning and goes till 11 at night with little time for freedoms is partly because it's been a CFP tradition to hold large plenary sessions to keep everyone together in the room rather than to do as many conferences do, which is to have a parallel track or multi-track and send people off into their own areas of interest. And we've always done this because we think the key to the CFP conference is to give people the opportunity who have different viewpoints, different interests, and different perspectives to come together and listen to one another, and we hope sometimes maybe even to have their views changed about an issue that they care very much about. And of course, the consequence of this program format, when you have so many interesting topics and so many interesting speakers, is that there's just not enough time to finish your coffee. So this is a somewhat long-winded way of asking you to please take your seats so we can now begin our next panel. Copyright on the line. Blame it on Rio or Title 17. And if you fully understand the significance of the title, you are a true CFP insider. You have a law degree. You are familiar with the latest in internet technology. You also have a hobby, seeing somewhat bad movies late at night. But you're here for the purpose of exploring what is quickly becoming one of the most significant issues on the internet today, and that is, how do we protect digital information and what are the consequences of the legal and technological solutions we come up with? And probably in no area has this debate been more provocative or more interesting than in the music industry. And the panel this morning looks at the copyright debate in the context of the music industry. To moderate this panel, I'm pleased to welcome Jonathan Zittrain, who is the executive director of the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Jonathan has been not only a leading scholar, but also a leading advocate in this arena, and has recently himself begun some significant litigation to test the bounds of copyright protection on the internet. Welcome very much to CFP.
Thank you and good morning. As Mark just explained, I'm executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. The Berkman Center studies law and its complement, and by that I mean law is known to constrain behavior in certain ways. That's certainly why it exists. Code can do so as well, and by code I mean technical code, technical architectures, the things that bind us when we stare at a screen, not just when we stare at a stop sign on the street. It can constrain certain behaviors, and it can facilitate certain others that had formerly been difficult. And indeed, some of these constraints or facilitations can be more powerful, and if they are constraints, more binding upon people than law could certainly hope to be, at least upon non-hackers. We certainly credit that there exist people that may be able to evade whatever technical restrictions can be placed upon them. The behavior that is so modified or constrained or facilitated is one that bears on rights, often. If you can freely copy something, there may be people who claim that that free copying may violate copyright. And in turn, that also can have a great bearing on markets and on industries. And that's something that is proven quite nicely and demonstrated in today's topic, which is on MP3, and more broadly the music industry or even the publishing industry, and the possible futures that await it as music finally finds its way digitally into a networked environment. Just briefly to lay out the issues as I see them, I'll describe them, then introduce our panelists, ask them to speak amazingly briefly in a highly compressed format, I would say about 10 to 1 compression, on their views on the futures. I'm sure it will be a lossless compression as they speak, and then open it up to an interactive discussion, first among us and then with everybody, as quickly as possible. So what do we know about MP3? Some basics are it's a way, a means of taking audio, compressing it. Indeed, there may be some loss, so it's not a perfect copy of that which it compresses. When it does compress, though, it makes it small enough that it's fairly readily shared and traded at today's bandwidth and speeds. An MP3 document can be copied like any other. It could be shared or even streamed like any other. And as a result, one might imagine great possibilities for not only copying and sharing of audio files, but also production and distribution. One can generate an MP3 in the comfort of one's home and spool it out onto the net and put it up for public consumption or at least availability, whether or not it's consumed is another question, quite readily. So the futures that we want to look at, I've at least grouped into three sections. First, the futures of the industry. How might the wide and easy availability of these technologies change the relationship between the artist and the listener and the various middle people that have heretofore been there to kind of mediate that relationship and say whether it's going to be the Spice Girls or someone else that we tend to listen to as we go about our daily chores? The second area is the technical. We are in an amazingly early stage of these technologies. I don't think anybody presumes that MP3 as a format is likely to be the be-all and end-all, and yet, given at least our idea about the way the control of code can control behavior, whatever the future format is may have a great bearing on what constraints we as consumers must live under, or constraints we as publishers or indeed artists may have to live under as well. It may be that the future holds but one format. Ask anybody that has an old Betamax as to whether there is support in the market in some segments for more than one format predominantly. So what will that format be and how will it be determined? Is it going to have, for example, something MP3 does not right now, which are watermarks and forensic trails, so that a given copy of music you may have on your hard drive and that you purchased from somebody is actually indelibly labeled as yours and it finds its way onto the net and there are lots of copies, everybody can know that you were the source. Will it allow for an amazingly refined control over the distribution of music such that publishers and artists can determine rights? I'd like this particular person to be able to listen 3 times to this song. This person only once. I'd like them to be able to share it with the following people, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, the third area is the legal area. In what ways will the final format, if such it is, end up controlling behavior that was formerly governed by law? Copyright sets out certain default provisions, certain things you're allowed to do if you have someone else's intellectual property in your hands, and certain things that you're not allowed to do, subject, of course, to enforcement by whoever holds the rights that you may be argued to violate. The technical architecture may or may not track that legal one, and that's something worth exploring. For instance, should there be fair use built into some particular audio compression and distribution scheme? And secondly, how is law used to help handicap the race as to what technology and accompanying features will predominate? In what ways is the law being used to say this particular format, for example, MP3 as represented on a Rio, that has been claimed to be by some against the Audio Home Recording Act? And again, law might be an instrument for helping determine what may be the prevailing technology that we'll have. So with that introduction, let me actually just introduce our panelists, starting just from my right to my farthest right. Has something weird happened with the audio? Is it me? Or?
No, it's still good.
Well, it's gone away. sort of. First is Michael Robertson, the founder and president of mp3.com. The website address for that is www.mp3.com.
That's very funny.
Yeah.
These guys are complete morons out here? You don't think they know my URL is mp3.com?
It was actually meant to be somewhat of a joke itself, but anyway, there's Michael.
These guys didn't laugh, so I was trying to help you out by segueing, but we've got a sleepy audience.
Michael's comments will be limited to approximately 10 to 15 seconds.
One bad joke.
Notice that controlling by law is more difficult than controlling by technology. If I could simply unplug the mic, it would be more effective. To Michael's right is Scott Moskowitz, the founder of BlueSpike, and somebody who can speak about these technologies and possible futures of them. To his right is Henry Cross, an artist and producer with Big Village. And then to his right is Carol Risher, Vice President of the American Association of Publishers, somebody grappling with these issues in texts, e-books, and such. And finally, Kerry Sherman, the General Counsel of the Recording Industry Association of America, one of the parties, in fact, the plaintiff to the lawsuit against Diamond Multimedia, seeking the injunction preventing the release of the Rio, which can take MP3 files and let you walk around with them, listen to them on airplanes and elsewhere. So with that, let me give the floor sequentially to each of these people to speak. Please, indeed, to keep it short so that we can open it up. Perhaps one thing to think about is, of these futures, what are your best dreams and your worst nightmares for what might come about? Thank you. Michael.
First of all, let me tell you that my admin who does my calendar, you know, usually a day or two before I'm supposed to go somewhere, she gives me an itinerary and says, well, this is where you're going. And so she says, you're going to D.C. and you're going to be on a panel, and what do you know about Title 17? And I said, what's Title 17? And so, of course, you guys all know that that's the copyright laws. And so she did a bunch of homework, but I want to set a little bit of precedent for where I'm coming from, and that is very much from an internet perspective. It's not a legal perspective per se. I'm not an attorney like at least some people on this panel. I am here to talk a little bit about sort of the MP3 movement and some of the positions that we at mp3.com have. I think most of you guys are probably familiar with MP3. Is that pretty much everyone's familiar with MP3? Great.
I see some heads shaking.
There's a couple points I think I'd like to start off with, and that is that the New York Times actually ran a story 2 days ago talking about the MP3 movement and how it's been portrayed as, you know, college kids gone crazy, but they contended in that article, and I would concur, that it's moved much beyond the Ventura voters, if you will, to a more general populace. A lot of the evidence today is anecdotal, but it's still pretty strong in that, you know, I met yesterday with AOL, and they're telling me their MP3 traffic is huge, and they're clearly not the early adopter community there. So I think the MP3 movement's really big. I also think that digital music as a whole is really inevitable. It's unstoppable. The amount of benefits that it brings to consumers is so compelling. The amount of benefits it brings to artists is so compelling that it really is inevitable. So in that framework, I want to just mention three things that we sort of hold firm to at mp3.com. The first one is that technology should enhance democracy. Today, in at least in the music business, you have a real consolidation, and it's really tough for artists sometimes to break through. And of course, that means that the consumers on the other end get a very small selection. And so we think that technology should enhance competition and democracy, and that really mandates an open standard that everyone can participate in equal footing. Two, we think that legislation shouldn't throttle technology or dictate business models. I think the best example of that to date is webcasting. If you look at the webcasting, you know, the online radio stations, they're horrible. They're absolutely wretched. I mean, you can go get a Save-On radio for $6, and it's better than a $2,500 PC set up as a radio listening station. Part of that is clearly bandwidth, but there's another really important fact here, and that is legislation, the rules, dictate what radio can do. And so it prevents people from having interactive radio stations. So I don't know about you, but we've always wondered when we listen to an online radio station, why can't you say, never play that song for me again? Or skip this song, it sucks. Or go back to that song, I want to hear it again. Or what are the next five songs? Well, you can't do all of that because if you do, you go to licensing jail. And that's a perfect example where you have legislation that's really throttling technology and preventing, I think, consumers from getting a better product. The third point is that citizens shouldn't have to surrender rights to be able to embrace these new technologies. We talk about music and people having an expectation of ownership, right? When you buy a CD, you know what you can do with it. You can, you know, bootleg it to a tape, put it in your car, sell it back to a record store. Some of these are legally mandated rights, such as, you know, the fair use and first sale doctrine, but nonetheless, they're rights and expectations. And we would want to be sure that any march towards digital music, consumers aren't asked to give up some of those rights in return for the new features and compelling aspects that digital music brings. I'll close with, we think that MP3 is actually a litmus test for digital media on the whole. I mean, people look at Amazon today, but you guys in this audience more than anyone know that that's not the model, that's not the challenge in the future, is, you know, books coming from warehouses. It's all about digital distribution. And I think how we treat MP3 today really sets the precedent and tone for other digital media properties in the future.
Thank you. It's amazing how easily fair use and first sale doctrine rolled off your tongue for somebody who just discovered Title 17. Do you have just a quick statement on your best dream and worst nightmare?
It will be quick. Actually, we're going to do a duet. Essentially, the issues that Michael bring up, shocking to many of you, is we're very much in agreement. I think there's been a lot of misinterpretation as to the technologies that we've introduced over the past 5 years. What we think is a very central argument to the issue of digital music and to the issue of anything being digitized is that the copies can be made perfectly. And all our tools do, which we call digital watermarks, using cryptographic or ciphered keys, for those of you who are more on the cryptographic side, is to ensure that because there is no magic location in a signal, that you can have a set of tools that enables third parties and others to differentiate one copy or establish responsibility for one copy versus responsibility for any other copy. I'm not an adherent, and I don't think any of our technology is really adherent to restricting any type of use over the content itself. Certainly the technology can cut in both directions, but I'm quite certain that the same way that you can't have end-to-end encryption solutions in controlling media, you are not going to be able to control what people do to content once they get it. What's my worst nightmare? Competitors using our terminology when it doesn't apply. I guess it's kind of an educational process. We are more engaged in the evolution of allowing artists and publishers to evolve from packaged media businesses, as Michael was alluding to, into powerful publishing companies and using their strengths as essentially media venture capitalists to get content out there. There will always be a need for filters the same way that folks choose magazines that they read. And I think those are the two powerful issues, are the change of how you control distribution and how you know where your content ends up. Did you understand that?
Everything.
Da, 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 next.
Okay, as the artist up here, I feel comfortable presenting the utopian view of things. As an independent artist, producer, and owner of a small production company, I for one am appalled by the music industry's heavy-handed attempts to restrict the development of MP3 technology. I personally I personally view MP3 and similar technology as a godsend and a salvation of the independent creative spirit, which has been crushed and colonized for much too long by the Orwellian dictates of major labels. With MP3 technology, any musician has an opportunity to reach a worldwide audience instantly and be judged on his or her own merit, which was unthinkable even a few years ago. We are witnessing a time when artists, instead of corporations and accountants, will be the ones deciding the state of the arts. This, of course, frightens the major labels because it means that someone like me, a virtual unknown with my $5,000 home studio, can access the same international exposure as a Phil Collins, a Puff Daddy, or a Spice Girls instantly. That is the real issue, control, not copyright infringement or loss of sales, as they would have you believe. I mean, who in this room can honestly say that 90% of the music on commercial radio is not crap? I mean, this is what they feed us. Where is the free-form, adventurous songwriting that we are probably intelligent enough to appreciate? People are tired of not having choices. How else can you explain a slump in the music business industry when the U.S. economy is experiencing its greatest prosperity since World War II? I mean, the music business is a bit on the skids right now, and I understand that they could be nervous about new technology giving basically the store away. I, for one, welcome the whole new set of rules which MP3 presents. If an artist's music is good enough and resonates with a certain audience, there are countless ways which fans will support them. The important step is directly accessing such fans, and MP3 makes it so much easier. It is time we view the internet as a unique opportunity to free ourselves of the old capitalist models and and possibly create systems based more on merit and less on hype. More importantly, we have to recognize when the ideal is being threatened by legislation designed to benefit a relative few. I believe the unregulated exchange of free music, culture, and ideas online is something to be cherished and protected. Thank you.
The question is not the technology. The question is the foundation of the copyright system. We, 20 years ago, people were arguing, making the same arguments in support of piracy in less developed countries. They said, the people have a right to know. Let them copy books. Let them get what they want at no charge because the rich countries have created it and are making enough money. When our country encouraged copyright regimes to be set up in Singapore, in Indonesia, in Korea, and in Taiwan, the first beneficiaries of a new copyright system were the indigenous authors. Because finally, there was a reason to invest in the creativity of the local authors to create books for the local market without fear of piracy. Piracy distorted the incentives built into the copyright system. Another problem we have today is there's a lot of misinformation. I understand when Jonathan said how easily the words fair use and first sale flow off the tongue of Michael Robertson. The fact of the matter is, our law doesn't have an unfettered fair use to use and copy everything. It's a balancing that you look at the amount of the portion used as it relates to the work as a whole, the effect of the use on the potential market for, the type of copyrighted work in question, and the type of use that's being made. It's not an open and shut case. The same copyright law that protects the well-known bestsellers, the well-known popular fiction and sound recordings, protects the individual poet. And the fact of the matter is, that poet who writes a poem and is fortunate enough to have that poem selected for an anthology or a book of poetry, doesn't make enough money just from the publication of the book. The monies that come to that poet are from all the additional uses. When that particular poem is selected to use in a classroom textbook, when that particular poem is set to music, when that particular poem is performed on a public television or public radio station, the incremental royalty streams for the additional uses are what makes the difference and keeps that poet writing the poetry and doing the creativity. The same thing occurs for the scholarly journal article. When you have a scholarly journal, it doesn't have advertising revenue. That article, the income to that article comes from the subscription, but also from the licensing fee when a library makes copies available for another library, when a document delivery service supplies that article. The copyright system that exists equally protects the individual work, the small work with the small audience, and the big work with the big audience. One of the things we have to think about in this digital environment is that digital uses are different. When you can take a copyrighted work in print and scan it and digitize it and make it available over the internet to the world, you can destroy the market for the additional licensing income that makes the difference between whether or not there is the creativity. And I just want to say one last thing on this topic, and that is, it's easy for people to think that the creative work goes from the author or the artist direct to the consumer. You don't realize the important role that the publisher-producer plays in not only making people aware of that work, but also developing a distribution system, even an online distribution system, that will get that content to the people who want to know about it. I know in my business, in the book publishing area and journal publishing, there's a tremendous amount of effort finding the people who are interested in the esoteric materials, making a market for them, and then getting the content to the people who want it. In the internet environment, there's three ways we get protection. One is the copyright law, which is essential as a framework for the incentive of creativity. The second is technology. We need to be able to protect the product in that internet environment so that it doesn't go to everyone, but just to those who are entitled to get it. And the third is the business models, and we're right now developing new business models of distribution. We have to recognize this is a new environment, but don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. The copyright law is the underpinning on which it's all based. Thank you.
I guess I feel something of an obligation to respond to a few of the remarks that have been made, but also to put it into a broader context. Contrary to popular belief and what you will usually read in the media, record companies have no problem with MP3. It's a fine technology. You can laugh, but the fact is that MP3 has become synonymous with MP3 piracy, and that's why the lines have blurred between whether the industry has a problem with MP3 or with MP3 piracy. We love the idea of artists having direct access to their customers, to finding a fan base, for niche artists to be able to get on the internet and find an audience that they wouldn't be able to find necessarily in a mass market environment. That is great for the music industry. The music industry wants you to have more music in more ways than you ever had before. Because the more you have, the more you're going to want more, and it's going to be an essential part of your life. So we love the opportunity of artists to do that. We just don't want it to be done in a way that also doesn't distinguish between the theft of the copyrighted content of artists. Artists ought to have the right
to put their stuff out for free if they want to. If Henry wants to do that, God bless him, he should go ahead and do that. But we shouldn't have a technology in place as a standard that doesn't distinguish between Henry making a decision to do that when Madonna may not want to do that, but the same technology can be used to rip Madonna tracks from a CD, put it up on the internet, and download it to millions of people worldwide. I don't think any artist would say that they don't want to get paid for their work, because ultimately, that's the only way they can make a living at their craft. So all we want is to have some kind of protection system in place so that artists can get paid. They can then make a decision whether for promotional purposes they want to make it available for free and hope that the sales will come later. That's fine. But don't have a system that basically takes away from every other artist the right to make the same decision. What we have done to try and distinguish between the piracy problem and the technology problem is launch an initiative called the Secure Digital Music Initiative. And the idea of this thing is to create a completely level playing field that will enable all sorts of new business models for everybody and anybody. Artists, retailers, aggregators like Amazon.com, record companies, and everybody else. The idea is to develop an infrastructure that will support a wide variety, an infinite variety.
Gary, there are no artists in SDMI. Excuse me for interrupting, but you know there are no artists.
Give Gary his chance. It would be nice if I had a chance, and I'd be happy to talk about that as well. An infinite variety of new agreements between content providers and users. You know, right now we have a relatively limited model for the way that music is sold. You know, you put it on a disc and it's sold physically. And that's about it. We would love to be able to sell people a listen, one listen, five listens, 10 listens, rent to own. You know, listen to it 9 times and the 10th time you own it. Subscription services directly from artists as new material is released or by genre. Copy it once, copy it 10 times. Email it to your friends. If they wind up buying a copy because they like the music, you get a little kickback. You get some kind of either commission or some kind of credit or something like that, the super distribution model. That stuff is going to open up an extraordinary variety of opportunities to disseminate music in new ways. That's what SDMI is intended to try and achieve, is to create an architecture that includes all of the technology industries, the consumer electronics industry, the information technology industries, all the vendors in between, so that music can be labeled at the source, no matter whether it's on a CD or on a DVD or in a computer file for a digital distribution system. It can be labeled in some way with what the usage rights are that come with that music. That data would be carried with the music no matter how it goes, whether it's through a telephone network or through a set-top box, whether it's just physically sold across counter, and then would be readable by every kind of device, whether it's a PC or a CDR or a reel, so that you would basically have the ability for the creator, whether it's the artist or his record company or any other creator, to have the ability to strike new kinds of deals with consumers. That is a way of empowering everybody and not distinguishing between what the source is. The technology has to be agnostic as to what the business model is. That's what we regard as the digital future. And you ask what the worst nightmare is? The worst nightmare is the internet, which is the most promising new communications medium imaginable, to be completely taken over by piracy to the point where these legitimate commercial opportunities disappear, because it ain't possible to compete with stolen copies of your own stuff. You can't sell on the same network something that people are able to get for free just as easily. So we have to try and find a way to bring piracy under control so that legitimate commerce can thrive, and then everybody's going to benefit, artists, consumers, and all the technology companies as well.
Thank you very much. I actually just heard Scott mumble that he wanted to ask a question, so why don't I actually, I've got a couple myself, but Scott, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I wanted to ask why those lights went on. No, I'm kidding. I have a similar kind of misunderstanding about the industry's interpretation of what they're trying to accomplish in SDMI, and for other reasons that Mr. Sherman is aware of, but perhaps most of the general public is not. I'm very confused as to exactly how public or non-public the decision of marking content and how important it is has been made or not made in a clear, transparent manner. I'm not personally, and neither is our company, in favor of marking content in a way that disrupts any types of privacy issues. But I am concerned with some of the issues with regards to implementations that promise technology or ascribe to certain types of business models like super distribution, which cut against the grain of the entire business and cut against the grain of the law of copyright, which is I own it, I want the control over it. So to help Michael ask his question, although we philosophically differ from others.
I thought this was your question.
The question is, how does SDMI reconcile its philosophy of what it's trying to accomplish and the lack of membership of the major label companies? They're not members of SDMI, to my knowledge. We're not a member of SDMI either. But
well, you may not be a member, but all the major labels are independent labels or representatives.
But
well,
we control the intellectual property that's necessary of what you're talking about. I was just curious about why they're not members listed on the site. If you want more of a transparent process to get the technologies you're trying to adopt, why wouldn't it be more transparent as to why they're not members? What is the benefit for technology companies or MP3.com or artists to join SDMI is basically the question.
I'm having trouble figuring out exactly what the question is, but let me just try and explain a little bit about SDMI. First of all, anybody who would like to find out more about it, I urge you to go to SDMI.org. It's a website that is set up for SDMI. There is a public section of the website. And if you look at the organizing plenary, you will find materials there that basically explain the objectives of SDMI. I basically made the presentation explaining the worldwide record industry's objectives with respect to SDMI, which I just did in a very shorthand way a moment ago. But it was basically saying to the technology industries that there is no long-term future in a pirate market. I'm sure we'll get to the Rio soon enough, but and the Rio could be regarded as a product that has found a niche where they could benefit from piracy. But the question is whether that's really a long-term business. The fact is that right now, if you want to go find an Eric Clapton song, you're probably going to spend 45 minutes to an hour looking for an illegal site that has it. And it's going to take you a long time to find it. And then when you finally find the link, you're going to find that it may be dead because we took it down because it was illegal or because it was an FTP server that could only accommodate 20 people at a time, or when you got it, the quality was poor. Now compare that with a legitimate market. I mean, how long are consumers really going to buy products like this if their consumer experience when they try to get music online is really a poor one? On the other hand, if you have a legitimate marketplace where the music is up there and accessible and easy to find, easy to download, it's a really satisfying experience, it works well with your portable device, everybody has created an interoperable, compatible system where the music flows. That's where a marketplace exists. That's where the future can be. And what we want to do is see that realized. And we want to see it realized in a way that benefits everybody. SDMI is a consensus process. Nothing will come out of SDMI unless it has the consensus support of the consumer electronics industry, the computer industry, as well as the music industry. If there's objection to it, it's not going to happen. It's being led by somebody who has made clear that that is the only basis on which a spec will come out. And it will be an open spec. It will be available for everybody to know exactly what kind of standards they are writing to so that they can create products and services that will support this new market.
So, Henry, let me ask you a question.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I'm just busting with things to say, believe me.
Okay, so let me start you with a question then.
Okay.
Suppose I were to say MP3 is going to give way to other formats, perhaps, and these other formats are going to have hooks in them so that somebody who wants to control the distribution of a file that he or she has created can more readily do so than is possible right now with MP3. They could put a header in the file that says not to be copied, and downstream recipients of the copies or of the original file would know not to allow to copy it and would refuse to allow the user to make a copy. Now, if that is an optional feature to the author, which is to say if you care to share your music totally widely, so you opt not to put that tag in and you say, no, let it go hither and yon, far and wide, do you have a problem then with the existence of that format? If it lets you do your thing, but at the same time has all these features so that those who wish to control their music in a blatantly capitalist way can do so, is that a problem for you?
It's a problem on a lot of levels. First, it's very...
Choose three.
Okay. It's very intrusive to think that we're bringing over this old model of regulation, et cetera, into this new arena. And that's my whole thing. I'm saying not that we're not to make money on this. I mean, it's possible to make a lot of money. It just requires a whole new way of thinking of it.
But I guess my question is, it's a whole new way of thinking that some people are ready to adopt now. Others are stuck in the old ways. They still want to have it the old way. You're saying, let's make sure they have to adapt to the new way. You can't have a technology that works for everybody, a sort of pro-choice technology that lets some authors give it away for free and others can lock it up really tightly.
I still think that's a bit halfway. I think it's time to get away from the old patronizing, we're doing this for you and everyone's welcome to kind of speak explain.
John, let me jump in here.
Sure, man.
And some comments here. First of all, let's talk about SDMI and what that really is. Listen, guys, that's an organized effort by the record labels to come up with a distribution system that they can control, that they can benefit from. What Kerry doesn't tell you is that the record labels have full veto control over SDMI, absolute veto control, right? No question about it.
Not so.
That is true. Number two,
look at the documents on the website.
Number two, there are no artists in SDMI. Right? So while Kerry rushes to the artist's defense at every step, which baffles me that the record labels are allowed to get away with, hey, we're defending the artist, right? That is nutso. They're not defending the artist. They're defending their constituency, which is the major record labels, right? So it's defending the artist is like talking about morality, right? It's un-American to not be for morality, right? It's un-American not to be for the artist. But Kerry's not for the artist, he's for his constituency, the people that pay his paychecks, which is the major record labels. So when it comes to SDMI, when it comes to legislation, he's not worried about open architecture, he's not worried about stuff that benefits him.
So Michael, let me just ask you to be specific. What would you identify about SDMI in the incarnation that it exists right now as you know it, that is a good example of harming the artist? What would you say is a feature of SDMI that is harmful to the artist but helpful, say, to a record company?
Well, it doesn't exist yet, so it's difficult for me to offer specifics of what it is, but you can just simply look at the framework. No one gets to play unless you get out your checkbook and pay 10 grand. There are no artists, there are no consumer advocates in that process whatsoever. You look at who's driving the whole process, who has veto over the whole process, it's the major record labels. I mean, it's not hard to jump from that to what kind of system do you think we're going to get out of that? I mean, look at the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was passed not too long ago. What the RIA did was snuck into that act a license that all webcasters now have to pay, that online radio stations have never had to pay and don't have to pay.
How would the existence of SDMI as you know it, this new technology that differs in significant ways from MP3 technology, how would it affect business on your website directly? Could you base MP3.com on SDMI files instead of MP3 files?
It's unclear what SDMI files are. I mean, it's absolutely unclear. They're just in the framework stages. But all we can do is look at the history here and say, well, let's look at the Madison project, a product they've announced with the major record labels setting up their own distribution system. They're not going to let the small record labels get into that. They're not going to let the independent artists participate in that distribution system. That's a system designed to benefit them. And it's logical to think that something like that's going to come out of SDMI as well. Hey, listen, I think artists should have choices, the whole range of choices. I'm not here to make a choice for an artist. But the reality is that SDMI, when they talked about the player spec for this player, we said, hey, we didn't say that, I wasn't even there. But people said, listen, the player spec needs to support MP3. They said no, right? They said no. So SDMI is not going to support MP3 for this player spec that they're working on. Right, so they're making the decisions by forcing people into the system that they want. I'm saying, hey, let's give artists and consumers and everyone a choice on what they decide.
So can I just respond a little bit here? It seems like almost all of the arguments you're making are based on this must be the case because it was true in other situations. Therefore, even though I don't know what's going on with SDMI and we don't really have any output yet to criticize, I've got to believe that it's bad for artists and that record companies are controlling it. And we're going to force our will on IBM and Microsoft and Sony and Toshiba and Matsushita and the other 110 technology companies that are participating in this. That's just not a real world view.
So, Carrie, let me ask you and perhaps Carol a quick question. And that is, part of the justification offered for a format that gives either the artist or the publisher, whoever is the author, the creator of the file in question, the power to lock it up more tightly and prevent derivative copies from being made, for example. Part of that justification is, hey, this is what the copyright law already provides for. We just want to make sure that it's a little bit self-enforcing so we don't have to actually go out and, you know, sue everybody that may copy these files. So let me ask you if you think the other side